Good evening. You're listening to WKCR-FM New York 89.9 on the dial and on the World Wide Web at www.wkcr.org. Tonight on Studio A, we have an hour devoted to a young writer who just happens to be my sister, Eugenia Burkowski. She'll be reading from Jackrabbit Conspiracies, a book that she wrote how long ago?
I'm 24 now. I wrote it. I started it when I was 18, just turned 18. It took me about 4 months to write and about the rest of my life to continue editing.
Right.
Yes.
Can I have some water?
Sure. We're both a little under the weather right now.
So can you give a synopsis of it?
A synopsis? It is, as most stories are, kind of a memoir. A lot of them are my own personal memories, but it's written from the perspective of a boy named Bobby who's about 8 years old living in New Jersey. And it's kind of his just like memories from his childhood, his very unorthodox and kind of like crazy family and the way he kind of perceived these situations in his like highly active imagination. And the basic concept in my mind is that an adult reading it would understand how kind of screwed up these situations were, even though he found them kind of amusing and just like his own reality. So, yeah.
Okay. So go ahead and read from the first story.
Okay. The novel is in two parts. The first part is when he's around like 7, 8, and 9 years old, and the second part is when he's an adult. And this is the second to last chapter when he's 8 years old. There may be parts, obviously, that you would have to have read the rest of the book to understand, but hopefully it's entertaining. Okay, chapter 9, Less to Love. Our social worker's name was Janet Butler. Janet stood 4 feet, 8 inches tall, making her legally a midget. She had short, stubby fingers with thick knuckles embedded in the center that looked like they should belong to an evil, conniving little gremlin, as opposed to the helpful addition in our lives that she was made out to be. This unfortunate affliction made it impossible for her to wear rings, which my mother claimed was probably the reason she was never married. I thought maybe the fact that she was a troll was a far better reason, but I didn't bother to argue. Janet would stop by our house every week or so to check on the family and make sure my parents were not putting me in an isolation tank or denying me my daily intake of calcium and whatnot. The entire development was brought on when my mother befriended a hippie woman who lived down the street. This woman, whose God-given name was Beatrice, but who called herself Ocean, taught yoga lessons in her home and held weekly potlucks for our neighborhood hippies. After a few casual chickpea and Waldorf salad lunches, my mother took to wearing sweaters that resembled rugs with holes cut out in them and listening to Indian meditation music. The woman had homeschooled her 2 young children, and after a month of lecturing my mother about the dangers of public education, my mother decided to pull me from school and teach me herself. It worked out fine for me, and although I did miss the human interaction that school provided, I soon became used to myself. Who needs to be social? Who needs friendship, communication, structure, and the sharing and spreading of ideas? Who needs these nominal ideas when you get to sleep in every day and be the envy of your peers? Under the conditions of my previous school, I had to attend weekly meetings at the community center where I sat around talking about my feelings and drinking fruit punch, which stained my tongue and lips and gave me a charge of energy that I have been unable to match to this day. The other condition was Janet. My mother refused to deal with Janet on any real level and thought very little of her visits, but my father took them very, very seriously. He made me clean the house from top to bottom every Tuesdays before her visits. I had to skip my emotional healing sessions for this, and after a while my counselor began to get suspicious until my mother told them that we were devoted atheists and had to keep Tuesdays sacred for our days of relaxation and worship. Although her explanation was a contradiction at best, they did not question us any further. Tuesdays were a riot for all parties involved. My father would wake me up at 6:30 in the morning, shove a cup of lukewarm coffee into my hands, and tell me to drink up and get to work. He found it very entertaining to watch me scrub the floor with my mother's ruffled apron on. My father would sit on the couch reading the paper with his feet up on the table and tell me, "Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, Bobby. You'll thank me for this one day." Because I got paid $5 a day for my work, it couldn't technically be considered child abuse, but I like to think of it that way. As I worked, I would pretend to be an indigenous servant working my way towards freedom. It kept things interesting, and I enjoyed working on my Cockney accent, or my version of it, which sounded like a combination between Irish and Spanish. I would talk to myself as I worked. One more day in this dark pit of hell is one day closer to freedom. Mister, father, may I use the toilet? My bowels are in a terrible state due to the cholera. I would gulp down my coffee as I worked, running to the sink to wash the bitter taste from my mouth. My brother Joe had explained the joys of caffeine to me when I was only 6 years old, forcing me to drink 3 steaming cups in a row as he sat across from me at the kitchen table. Do you feel anything yet? He asked. I looked down at my shaking hands and tried to stop my foot from tapping a Morse code against the linoleum. My arms are tingling, and I'm pretty sure I could jump off the roof and land on my feet unscathed. After one more cup, Bobby, you definitely could, he said, refilling my mug. Our house wasn't large, but cleaning it still took most of the day. Under my suggestion, my mother and father didn't allow me to eat until I had finished all my work. It was helpful in the starving servant role I was getting into. When I was finished, my parents would walk around the house, running their fingers over tables and ledges, checking for dust. I would sit on the couch, waiting for their report, trying to ignore the growling in my stomach. Usually they would find something I had neglected to clean. A spot of urine behind the toilet, coffee grounds hidden under the stove, a smudge of dust hidden between the cracks of the television. They'd walk into the living room with their hands pressed together in front of their mouths, causing them to resemble monks in prayer as they sighed dramatically, lifting their eyes to the ceiling theatrically, as if to summon up the necessary courage it would take to discipline me. To the dungeon, boy, you're a disgrace to your country, my father would bellow. Release the tack monkey, sir. I'll fetch the beating stick, my mother would suggest, giggling in spite of herself. A terrible flogging will shortly ensue. Run, boy, I implore you. Run for your life. It was the most fun all of us had all week. Janet usually came by on Wednesday evening. She would switch up the time of her visits every week or so in what my father said was a sad attempt to catch us off guard. We were always ready for her arrival by 4 in the afternoon, as she never came earlier than that. My father would stuff me into my Easter suit, a piece of clothing purchased at the Goodwill years before, which was in danger of unraveling with even the slightest jerky movement. He would sit me on the couch and give me my usual props. He would hand me a dictionary and a highlighter and instruct me to pretend to do research and try not to look too much like a retard. When change was in order, I was handed an impressive-looking book, quite thick with small print and many pretentious references in the margins. To add to its intrigue, my mother's oversized spectacles were placed on the bridge of my nose. My mother would stand in the kitchen doorway as we set our stage, scoffing and making sarcastic remarks. Her lack of involvement in our effort was not appreciated by either my father or me. The first week Janet arrived, I was pretending to read Democracy in America. Now, 3 months later, I was working my way through Pride and Prejudice, which my father thought might prove that we were not only a respectable and worldly family, but that we also didn't discriminate against midgets. I'm not exactly positive as to how he came up with that conclusion, but I'm pretty sure he'd never actually read the book. After I was propped up on the couch, looking as studious as I could muster, my father would put on his Spanish for Beginners tape and pace around the room, mimicking the tape in a flat American accent. He had somehow concluded that all well-rounded parents were bilingual and pretended to speak Spanish in order to impress Janet. We would sit on the couch, rehearsing our lines, until we heard Janet's Volkswagen pull up outside. Then panic mode would set in. You look too stiff, Bobby. Relax. Look smart. Uncross your legs. You look like a pansy. Button your pants. Get the hair out of your eyes. Get your damn feet off the table. Honey, pretend to be cooking. I'm thinking well-balanced meal. None of that indiscreet carcass mixture you usually poison us with. Go chop celery or something and look natural. Put on an apron. Hide the booze. Put out that goddamn cigarette. And on and on and on. When the doorbell finally rang, my father would flip on his Spanish for Beginners tape and pace around the room 5 or 6 times in order to compose his shot nerves. Then he would casually walk to the door as if he had forgotten it was Wednesday and we had all been caught off guard. I could hear them greeting each other in the hallway. It was always the same thing. Hola, Janet. What a lovely surprise. Buenos dias. Is it Wednesday already? You caught us completely off guard. The house is a disaster. I apologize for the mess. We haven't had a chance to clean up. We've just been so busy. Bobby, he's around here somewhere. He's probably got his nose buried in a book. We tell him to go out and play, but all he wants to do is improve his mind. What can we do? Then an artificial chuckle. He's an intellectual, you know. That's just the way it goes. Then more forced laughter and on until they finally discovered me in the living room. I would try and look surprised as they walked in, pushing the oval bifocals up high on my nose and carefully closing my book as if I had been interrupting in the midst of an extremely interesting development. I still didn't know if Janet believed our charades or not. She always wore the same "I just consumed something unappetizing and possibly rotten" expression on her flabby nest of a face, and it was rare to see her pursed lips stretch into a smile. Janet and my father would involve themselves with idle chit-chat in the living room as my mother chopped cilantro or spinach into large abrasive piles and cast an occasional irritating look over her shoulder. After a few minutes, we would usually relocate to the dining room where the three of us would talk for an hour or so. I would recite my lines with confidence and poise as previously instructed by my father. My mother would enter the room offering a variety of nutritious-looking greens to our guests.
Hello.
It's my name.
Are we hearing each other?
Yes. I'm hearing Good. You.
All right, so that was just a little excerpt that we had to cut short, a bridge, if you will. But I wanted to ask Eugenia a few questions about that piece that she just read about, her feelings about it now, since it's been a while since you wrote it.
Well, it's kind of interesting. It's like when you read back on, like, your diary entries from when you were 12 years old and you cringe about how embarrassing you were, et cetera. There's a lot of parts, because it has been a long time since I wrote that book, and there's a lot of parts in it that I think are actually still really good and relevant to, I guess, where I am now in my life. But a lot of it is kind of juvenile, and the style of writing is really different from what I'm currently doing. So it's kind of been sitting there stagnantly for a while. And every once in a while I go back and kind of fiddle with it and edit it, but I don't really know if I ever would want it to be published at this point because it's been too long, you know.
Is it uncomfortable for you to listen to your work read multiple times?
No, it's not uncomfortable, but I think it's weird because when you're actually writing a book and when you're reading it aloud, it's very different, and I'm not exactly the best, like, public reader or... You know,
right.
The content is, I mean, I remember it like the back of my hand, but.
Right. Why did you decide to write from a boy's perspective?
Actually, I guess I pretty much all of my stuff is usually from the point of view of a male, and I'm not really sure. I guess it feels more familiar to me. Like, I don't really write females very realistically, and I feel like I'm right males better. This particular character was actually based on a very good friend of mine who you know, Bobby. I won't say his last name. And I asked his permission, but I stole a few of his childhood stories from it too, but I always imagined him in my head when I was writing it.
So what is the piece that we're going to hear a little bit of? Could you introduce that?
Sure. This is the second novel that it's not yet completed, but that I wrote after the Jackrabbit Conspiracies. It's called Grandma Blue Jay and the Seventh Spawn, and it is about a very eclectic, kind of crazy, artistic family. There are seven siblings who are all estranged from each other. And the first half of the book is basically just introducing each one of these characters, and they're all actually based on all my siblings. And each chapter just revolves around those people. And at the end of each chapter, one of the siblings delivers them a package, and you don't really know for the first part of the novel why they're getting these packages, et cetera. You eventually discover that the grandmother is trying to get them all in under the same roof, and they haven't really spoken for a very long time. She's trying to get them all under the same roof so that she can figure out who to leave her money to when she dies. And the task at hand is that she thinks that they're all very morally corrupt individuals. So she says that whoever can change into a moral, decent person before she dies will get her money. And so it kind of turns into this thing where you have to, like, figure out your own definition of morality and what that means to you.
Interesting.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, I just wanted to, remind the listeners that you're listening to WKCR 89.9 FM, and that this is Studio A. We have two arts programs at the arts departments here, and it's Arts and Answers, which is a 30-minute show, and then Studio A, which is an hour long. And this is a kind of first-time thing. I'm calling it the Young Writers Series, but I think the idea is to get, you know, young people out there who are writing who might not really feel they have a community to share it with and bounce back ideas with, because it's somewhat loaded. I have many friends who write, but they are very ashamed to admit that they want to be a writer. It seems like a very lofty, almost antiquated...
It's kind of a dying art form.
Yeah, people don't read it anymore, but unfortunately, any media that you consume, any art you consume is somewhat based in literature. I mean, I'm not quoting anything there, but so I just wanted to say, if you had any interest in the ideas that we're putting forward on this show tonight, send me an email. I just would like to gauge if there's any interest out there. Mary.Borkowski, that's Mary, M-A-R-Y dot B-O-R-K-O-W-S-K-I at gmail.com. But right now we're going to listen to the second excerpt of Eugenia's work. Did you want to add something?
Oh, I just said if anyone has any questions about my work, you can also contact me at it's under UNDER period A period pedestal PEDESTAL at gmail.com. I love getting emails as long as they're not creepy.
Yeah, so it would be great to get a response from what we're putting out there tonight. And thank you, Gina, for sharing your work. So here's the first two chapters of
Grandma Blue Jay and the Seventh Spawn.
Great.
Lily crossed her legs while she peed. During dinner, she would line up her utensils along the border of the table and eat her meals with her fingers, carefully wiping the messy beds of her hands against the hem of her skirt. Between bites. She liked to peel the labels from the imported bottles of beer she nursed from, taking them off with one smooth sweep, like the peel off of a banana or a sticker from a frosted window pane. She would do this with a look of immense concentration overcoming her brow, her lower lip protruding dramatically from her face, eyes squinted, the way I must look when I peeled a potato or tried to remember the one sonata I had learned on the piano. It was a look that said, I'm doing this from start to finish, and I don't care how long it takes or how ridiculous I look like in the process. On Sundays, Lily liked to take her two Siamese cats, named Dog and Bird, for a walk around the Twin Lakes surrounding the neighborhood. She bundled her cats up in uncomfortable-looking sweaters, knitted by her own hand for just such an occasion, and trapped them into their matching pale blue harnesses, embellished with bright purple rhinestones and little clanging bells. She exercised these delicate beasts in the same way a loving mother would exercise an overweight daughter with heart problems, coaxing and cooing, praise for every successful bead of sweat, or in this case, the evidence of a pink panting tongue. When Lily was too tired, it became my task to take these miserable beasts for their walks around the lakes, an exercise which caused me much embarrassment. I opted instead to carry the harnessed animals, one under each arm. I'm not sure which was the oddest sight, Lily proudly trotting the petite kitties behind her, or me rushing to complete the trek with the cat under each arm, their leashes bobbing in the dust behind me. Mondays were Lily's days dedicated to spending money on things she desperately did not need. I was forced to come along on every outing, carting with me this and that, bags of groceries, lamps and antique tables, and large bouquets of fresh flowers wrapped in colored cellophane, which she purchased from a Chinese man with a glass eye who sold them dirt cheap by the side of the road bordering our sedated city with the next. Lily didn't believe in cars. She didn't believe in television. She didn't believe in the lazy or the obese. She would throw about these sweeping statements of disbelief, not in a way that one could pass off as merely disapproving, but in a manner indicating that, in the mind of Lily Butler, these things did not exist at all. However, Lily did believe in servants, but not servants who were expected to be paid for their efforts. I became her unpaid servant after the end of my second marriage when I came to stay with her in an attempt to start a new life in the early spring of 1984. My ex-husband, a philanthropist musician with small, cold hands and an inky mustache, had left me for a woman who played sitar in the subway station and supplemented her income selling pieces of smooth, colored glass at the Wednesday flea markets in Soho. They had met on the beach. He had broken the ethereal news to me over dinner as I sat picking at my steak with my butter knife and smoking my 16th cigarette over the blue flame candle in the middle of our table. His teeth had turned a pale purple from the wine he had been drinking in big, sweeping, lusty gulps. I could see him eyeing me from behind that big tulip glass, his left eye weaving and expanding behind the thick, curled rim. As he spoke, I imagined taking my steak knife and plunging it into that cold, glistening socket, feeling the tip of my knife penetrate the yolk of his eye and sinking into his head until nothing but the base remained, sticking awkwardly out of his face. I imagined the hysterical laughter that would well up unrepentantly inside me as I signaled to the waitress for our check, while his blood began to pool in a soft wave over his cheeks and mouth. "Would you stop fiddling with your knife, please? It's making me nervous," he had said, moistening his lips with another gulp from his glass. I laid my knife on the side of the plate and lit up another cigarette, blowing the smoke as violently as I could around his face. He squinted sadly at me and concentrated his eyes on my shoulder. "Aren't you going to say anything?" I paused then, trying to think of something appropriate to say, something which would burn him, scald him, sock him in the head with the force and weight he deserved. Something mean and icy, straight from my mouth and into his soul with the precision of a calculating bullet. "Ice cream," I finally said. "I think I'll order an ice cream." And I motioned to the waitress. 2 weeks later, the house we had shared was empty. I had telephoned my grandmother and requested I stay with her for a short period of time while I set my life in order. A short period of time had stretched into 2 years. Lily instructed that I call her Grandma Blue Jay. I was first in the family to do so. And to her, I was always the seventh spawn, or in private, simply blank. Lily signed the lengthy letters which she wrote weekly to the editors of our local entertainment sources, Grandma Blue Jay and the Seventh Spawn. She spent most of her Sundays compiling these essays of criticism, addressing them to this Home and Garden magazine and that local paper. Above her bed, on the teetering bookshelf held to the wall by two spindly nails, was her collection of all the magazines and papers she had ever been published in. There were 142 such articles, all written to the editor and all signed with a ridiculous pseudonym. Before I had come along, she was Grandma Blue Jay of Buckler Hills. And before that still, when my grandfather had been alive, she was Grandma Blue Jay and the Dusty Beard. There was no evidence that she had written any of these letters before becoming a grandmother. Lily did not believe in phones, so Wednesday was dedicated to letter writing. I would curl up on the hot leather chair by her fireplace with a stack of flower-emblazed stationery as Lily dictated long, gushing letters to her acquaintances, most of whom lived right down the street, and one of whom resigned most months out of the year in the summer house directly behind our garden. She would save the letters addressed to my siblings for last. All six of them received one letter a week, written in my own loopy, crooked writing. The letters outlined the past week and always accentuated the need for a visit. My youngest sister, Mary, and our eldest, Kate, resided just miles from us in New York City. Though the two of them lived within walking distance from one another, they never spoke, and when meeting each other at social gatherings, looked in opposite directions and pretended they did not see each other. Mary was Mary was a right-wing Republican who made her living giving away promotional cigarettes to drunks at bars and passing out cartons of menthols to the middle school students in Harlem. She had been in graduate school at Columbia University for nearly a decade and had been working on her thesis entitled Apes, Apes, Apes for almost 4 years. Kate was married to her fourth husband, a Haitian reggae singer who insisted on being called Banana. Despite her inability to carry a tune, Kate had been touring with their band, the Blue Bananas, for 6 months as their lead singer. Kate had two twin girls who spoke only Swahili and had large, unblinking eyes and manes of frizzy, coffee-colored hair. I had only met them in pictures. My lone brother Ian was spending some time at sea after the mistake which wrecked his career as a writer and a short spurt as an accountant, which led him to Mexico, where he attempted to sell bonsai plants to the villagers at 400 pesos a tree. He went to sea with his longtime companion, Chin Lee, an ex-martial arts instructor who fractured his leg in six places after demonstrating the lotus leap for a class of 5 to 11-year-olds at the community Y and had to retire early. The two of them had been out of commission for a year, sailing somewhere in the post-Atlantic on a boat borrowed on credit from our grandmother. Inga and Sarah, the middle children, stayed somewhere in the hills of San Francisco. They shared a loft with a grumpy man in his early 70s who constantly complained about their smoking, and their long-haired tabby cat who shed profusely from spring to winter and howled out the open window as soon as it got dark. Sarah spent her days teaching arts and crafts to mentally disabled adults at the Jewish Community Center. She'd had a short spell as a millionaire in her early 20s when she invented a self-heated toilet seat, but most of her fortune had been liquidated into lawyer fees after an unfortunate incident involving customs, a man named Harry, and 2,000 grams of Colombian cocaine. Inga drove a trolley car around San Francisco. A replica of the original, it was a cable car with no cables, a tour bus meandering through the most boring sights in the city, and she, the unenthusiastic guide. She spent her nights doing crossword puzzles, an obsession of hers, and popping codeine, which she got from her infatuated She spent her nights doing crossword puzzles and popping codeine, which she got from her infatuated dentist twice a week. Like Inga always said, there's nothing more exciting than a fresh crossword puzzle washed down with a few little white companions. Inga had almost married once, but had left her husband-to-be the day before their wedding. She traveled across town to a friend's house in a bathrobe with a towel wrapped around her wet head. She had ridden two trains and a bus in that fashion to get there. Inga and Sarah had not seen each other for 15 years when they moved in together. Sarah had been carted off to boarding school for setting a church on fire when Inga was just 8. They had a 9-year age gap between them, though you wouldn't know it by looking at them. Sarah had put out an ad for a roommate a few years back when her current roommate had gone crazy and threatened to set her bed on fire as she slept. Inga answered the ad and had talked to Sarah on the phone for 20 minutes before either of them realized they were speaking to their sister. They decided they had to move in together, whether they liked it or not, figuring, given such an unusual circumstance, that it was fate. Eugenia, the next in line after me, was staying with a Mormon family somewhere outside New Brunswick, New Jersey, the city where we were born. She worked at a Polish deli on the weekends with a married man named Vermin. On weekends, she pet sat at a reptile and bird store specializing in pythons and exotic parrots. She slept by the cages on an inflatable mattress that she kept behind the radiator and would sing the snakes to sleep and call back and forth to the taloned birds into the wee hours of the morning when she would go home and sleep some more. Eugenia made long-themed mixtapes with titles like In the Event of Drowning or Sorrow on a Sunday, and sent them to the seven of us every month in shoeboxes bound with silver duct tape. The tape she sent to me always involved water or birds. The ones to the others were usually more scattered. She left me long, teary messages on my answering machine about the cancer she was sure she had, her ingrown toenail, which she was positive was the root of her poor balance, and each and every cough or cold, which went on for far longer than it should have. She started each message with, not that you give a damn, but, and ended each message with, but don't worry, I'm sure I'll be fine. Grandma Blue Jay and I wrote letters to each of them without taking into account their individual personalities or characteristics. Each letter was written formally and precisely, much like her editorials. In her own way, Lily despised each and every one of them, calling them hedonistic wenches behind their backs. I had escaped the wrath of Lily by living with her, but I felt I deserved a bit of her flying contempt in order to instill a feeling of togetherness between my six siblings and myself. Though I tried to keep in personal contact with all of them, my endeavors always fell short of sincere. I waited for the wave of guilt to overcome me after not speaking to one of them for more time than could be explained, until finally picking up the phone and calling. I hadn't contacted Ian since he set off to sea a year ago. I had read, as we all had, about his lawsuit against the man who stole his latest novel, and the embarrassing fit he had thrown at the bookstore at East 77th Street and Broadway upon hearing of its publication. I talked to him shortly after that episode, when he was briefly hospitalized, but had yet to hear his voice since he'd gone off to Mexico. I'd heard through the grapevine from Eugenia, who had always been his favorite, mostly due to their mutual love of intoxication, that the trip of to Mexico had been a floundering failure, besides the fact that he had been reunited with his friend Chin, who was taking it easy at a residence. Blah, blah, blah. The trip to Mexico had been a floundering failure, besides the fact that he had been reunited with Chin, who was taking it easy at a residential hotel after his accident, and that they had both learned a touch of Spanish. Kate would put her children on the phone with me and practice her vocals in the background, while I listened to her two kids explain their daily adventures in their barking Swahili. I could never get through to Inga and Sarah, whose landlord would answer the phone and scream that he didn't know who I was referring to and wished I would stop tying up the phone lines with prank calls. I prank called my sisters in San Francisco about twice a week. I spoke with Mary regularly. She would put me on hold as she went to the bathroom or organized her bookshelf, placing the receiver next to whichever movie she was watching or whatever record she was playing. She had always been excellent in the art of multitasking. Eugenia and I corresponded by answering machine only. Most of the time I'd leave a message only to receive one from her 2 minutes later, after she'd received the information I had given her. We had not had a real conversation in over a year, the longest game of phone tag imaginable, and one which I could surely not have survived without. With the bits and pieces of their lives scraped together in my mind by the many details I had collected, I was able to argue with our grandmother when Lily went on her rampages about their lives of sin and their resilient behavior, which would surely send each and every one of them straight into the pits of hell. Despite her contempt, the planning of a reunion involving the eight of us was often discussed. Plans were laid out, but it just never seemed to happen. Grandma Blue Jay would not rest until we were all in her house, a miniature audience to the sermon on integrity which she wished so dearly to preach. The seven of us had been together in the same room only once, a few months after the passing of our mother Miriam. A photo had been taken, slightly askew, picturing the eight of us in our Sunday best, squished together on our grandmother's red vinyl couch, our bodies and faces looking tight and awkward. We each received our copy of the picture in the mail a week after we had dispersed, with a note from our grandmother about what a wretched time she had had and how she wished the trip had gone differently. I put the picture in a cracked black frame, which I set on my bedside table next to my alarm clock and a box of tissues. Grandma Blue Jay put her copy of the photo in the bathroom cabinet under a bottle of disinfectant, which bubbled over a few weeks ago, smearing the thin plastic surface of the pictures and muddling our faces. I had removed the picture from the cabinet after the spill and, in an attempt to restore it to its natural state, wiped the top of the photo with my thumb, smearing the outline of the faces into a blotchy brown mess. The picture now shows eight slightly bubbly bodies, our faces now a clean brown streak, unrecognizable to anyone but ourselves. Footnote. Now that you have, as most imaginative readers do, built a picture in your mind of the way these characters look on the surface, their physical qualities, as it were, I am here to make a rebuttal. I will do this at the end of each introductory chapter, characters chapter. I will do this at the end of each introductory character's chapter. Please feel free to skip ahead while reading in order to make an accurate description of my characters, which you may or may not resort to. Or, on the contrary, you have the freedom to ignore the images I am transporting into your mind and use your own instead. It makes no difference to me. Lily. Lily, as a young woman, was exactly the opposite of striking. Yet in her manner and her gestures, she had the marvelous ability to embed herself into your mind despite the physical attributes that usually are required to make such an impression. Her hair was black, not barely brown or jet coffee, but a true black, one that looked blue in the brightness of the sun. As age dawned upon her and finally overtook her, her hair refused to cooperate, staying to this day the same salient ebony. Her mouth was small, almost undefiably pursed, in a sour expression, as if she might spit venomous poison in your direction at any moment. Her nose was nothing noteworthy, despite the fact that in comparison to the rest of her features, it was almost lost in its smallness. The eyes were perhaps the most striking thing about Lily. They looked like large watery pools in an otherwise desolate horizon. Like a lot of the other members of the family, they were blue. Not blue jay blue or periwinkle blue, but a deep sea blue, the type you might find at the very bottom of the sea when you are certain you have gone too far and will surely drown. Chapter 1, Ian. The grand details of an incident no one saw. Upon a lazy undertone of civility and poise, lies there a monster hunched to pounce, omitting little noise. And wait I did for said affair as much as waiters do, accepting each small particle bestowed the meaning to a clue. Though underneath it all there seemed a steadfast looming grasp, which in its bounty did appear an alm in which to tap. I could not tell you when or where how solemnly her touch, but only that my last affair was aided by her crutch. Ian M., published in the New Almanac of Children's Verses, 1969. Ian had written his first novel at the age of 18. It was 657 pages long and took place in a single afternoon. His reviews had been terrible, and the success of the book even worse. He often joked that I had been the only one who had ever actually read it all the way through, though in fact I had only gotten to page 411 before throwing it up in the air in disgust. He wrote under the pseudonym Theodore McAllister III, which I believe was really the reason for his failure. Ian then spent the next 10 years holed up in an efficiency hotel in Harlem, attempting to write something to redeem himself and place him on the literary map in some small way. His room smelt of cigarettes and vodka, and had the slight odor of dirty cat litter which drifted in from the veterinary office directly outside his window. He woke up every morning to the crowing of roosters and fell asleep to the sounds of adolescent pigs being fed their slops. In the room directly next to his lived his longtime friend Chin Lee, who worked across town at a plant shop specializing in bonsai trees, and also taught kung fu at the Y to supplement his income. Chin would visit my brother every day or so, bringing with him a new little bonsai tree and the paper. Sometimes he would even bring crackers, thin walnut wafers, a specialty in his country, and the only food Ian could currently keep down. Later, while they were at sea, they had boxes of these crackers shipped to them by helicopters carrying weapons to third world countries. Chin Lee had a long, curled beard and smoked thin brown cigarettes, using each one to light the next. He had briefly run a whorehouse in China, where he met his ex-wife, Yi, a Korean masseuse, who died from a complication involving ulcers and motion sickness shortly after accompanying Chin to the United States. Ian and Chin bonded over their mutual failure and heartache and became fast friends. The mistake which cost my brother his sanity began on the date of June 27th, 1985. He had finished his second novel and received his first rejection letter from his agent, which stated in a blunt, cruel manner that they were never interested, would never be interested, and would almost rather publish a book about pedophilia fantasy. Pedophilic? Rather, almost publish a book on pedophile fantasies over this rambling piece of nonsense. Ian, not being one who was at all able to accept this kind of criticism, promptly took the hard copy of his manuscript and tossed it out his fourth-story window where it landed in the street below. Moments later, it was picked up by a man named Teddy Kaminski, a Polish poet known for his gourmet cooking skills and his inability to tell a good lie. The book was then published 6 months later under the name Key Kaminski and received rave reviews by both the Post and the New York Times. Ian discovered that he had been ripped off upon visiting a bookstore, a locally owned chain with pale green walls and an orange cat, whose age, although unknown, was accentuated by the patches of missing fur he left behind and the eyesight which had come and gone somewhere around the second stage of his life. My brother would spend time there when he was feeling blue, perusing the new titles and marveling about how so many untalented and undeserving young writers climbed the ladder of literary success with books like NYC or Bust and A Tale of Two Twin Sisters. Then, nostalgically and coyly, he ended up in the M section, a pale-skinned moth drawn to the same seductive flame. He looked for the thick, black-bound book so familiar to him and removed it from the shelf as if discovering it for the first time. He allowed himself time to run his fingers over the smooth binding of his own failed piece of literature, skimming over the pages he had toiled over for years and finally placing it back on the shelf, cover facing outward. On the date of June 27th, my brother stumbled upon another book, and, intrigued by the cover and the oddly familiar title, picked it up and sifted through a few of the first pages. On the date of June 27th, my brother stumbled upon another book, and, intrigued by the cover and the oddly familiar title, he picked it up and sifted through the first few pages. He read the first sentence aloud. The cat stood by the window waiting for spring. As a silver lining of the winter moon moved into the sidelines and made way for the arrival of a new season, the cat still sat. Ian recalled these words the way a child recalled the loss of their first small white tooth, the way a dying man recalled his passing life. They struck him hard and furious in the delicate place between his ribs, knocking the air from him and punching out his ability to render a new breath. It was the first sentence that he had slaved over for hours, replacing this word with that, trying to capture the mood of changing seasons and loss. He flipped the book over and saw a picture of Mr. T. Kaminski, pictured wearing a Bermuda shirt, standing below a weeping willow, the limbs reaching for a pond of silver and blue. Ian flipped to the middle of the book and mumbled a few more sentences aloud. I agree completely. Then another sigh, this one heavier and more ridiculously displayed than the first. The color drained from Professor Fee's flabby nest of a face and were quickly replaced with another crimson color, much richer. At this point, Ian had no doubt in his mind that the words he was reading were his own. The initial shock had worn off and was now being replaced somewhere inside his stomach with a wave of furious nausea. Despite his own wishes, he read on, a bystanding rubbernecker, unable to look away from his own car crash. It was his hope, it seems, that somewhere between here and the next page there would be some obvious difference, a change in tone, a change in sentence structure, any evidence that this was a mistake, and that these words, which at this point he knew were his own, had just been borrowed as an entryway to a story that he had not written. Ian read on for a few more moments but stopped when he felt the taste of bile rising just below the surface of his throat. He dropped the book on the ground with a dull thud, receiving a look of disapproval from the man standing next to him. Ian looked around, trying to map out how long it would take to exit the building before the vomit rose from his stomach, the tears from his eyes, and the howl, which was itching to rush from his lungs, out of his throat, and exit with a sound that resembled, "Motherfucking piece of shit!" But it was too late. The other patrons looked up, trying to match the curses to the culprit. Any effort to save face was gone, and Ian proceeded to lose it completely and without shame, amidst the stacks of books and startled customers. A few people made their way quickly to the exit. "Sir," the man behind the counter, behind the front desk said. "Sir," the man behind the front desk said, picking up the receiver of the telephone beside him. "I'm going to have to ask you to leave this second, or I'm going to have to call the police." "Call them! Call them! Call them, you fucking half-wit piece of worthless shit," Ian reportedly had said, kicking in a stack of books out of his way. "I would adore it if you called them. Call them and tell them that someone has stolen a piece of my mind. Tell them that a certain Mr. T. Kun-something-ski Polish motherfucker has stolen my book, my thoughts, my fucking words and sweat, ripped apart my fucking soul and displayed it for all the fucking universe to absorb. Why don't you tell them that? I would love it." According to the police report sent to me by my grandmother, Mr. Molliday, resident of New York City and failed novelist, then proceeded to throw about Polish racial slurs in an array of profanity, while ripping apart racks and tearing pages out of various books. As the police were being summoned, he tore books from their shelves, knocked over racks, and threw up on the floor before being let out of the building by security. He had knocked an 8-year-old girl unconscious while disassembling a rack of cookbooks and fractured an elderly woman's legs as he kicked violently into the direction of the cash register. They put Ian in prison for exactly 3 days before he was handed over to the mental health board and put in a home for the emotionally disturbed. There he mingled with the disillusioned and the paranoid, fitting himself in as nicely as a round peg in a rounder hole. After being released from the hospital, he managed to secure a job at a local attorney's office who had defended his case to no avail, and had offered Ian a job as a consolation prize after the fact. There, Ian spent his days hunched over stacks of receipts, some of which were even his own, filing and calculating and growing more and more agitated and infuriated with the mess his life consisted of. He stayed there for 7 months, returning after work to his room, where he would water his bonsai plants and stare at the same blank piece of paper on his typewriter, unable, he reported to me later, to come up with a single original thought worthy of being punched onto that page. In March, I received the following letter. "My dear Sister Blank, when you drink all day and sleep all night, there's really no room in one's life for repercussions. Or is it the other way around? The former Theodore McAllister III, now Teddy, due to a drop of rank or a few too many drops in the buckets, promised me he would break the cycle and make a visit to the pharmaceutical office first thing Monday morning so the rest of us could get some shut-eye. It didn't pan out. Weeks earlier, I had been indulging in a week of constant limbo, teetering over from the edge of perpetual insanity to a full-blown cuckoo clock. I haven't worked a real hobnob 9-to-5 job since 6 weeks and counting. If a story begins with a riddle, it must end with an answer. If you begin with the answer, there's nowhere else to go but back up to the beginning. It could have been then that I lost it, much to my delight, and upon regaining it, found it had morphed into something much too pure to ever form an opinion about. On February the 16th, I walked into my office, plunked down a stack of unfinished work onto my boss's immaculate varnished desk, and told him to go fuck himself, his mother, and anything else he could get his little tiny cock into. 2 hours later, I was escorted out of the building by two security guards with walkie-talkies strapped to their belts. They told me if I ever set foot in the building again, I would be shot in the face with a tranquilizer dart and kept in the basement for a fortnight. Where do they come up with this shit? On February the 20th, I walked back into the office to get something I forgot and was promptly shot with a tranquilizer dart, right in the neck below my left ear. I was just trying to pick up my bonsai plants from my corner office before leaving the country, but they never gave me a chance to explain. The plant hadn't been watered in a week, its limbs looking sad and old from a quarter, which allowed no sunlight. That's really what broke my heart about that day. On the last day of February, I packed 3 crates filled with bonsai plants, carefully wrapped in yards of moist saran wrap to keep them supple and lubricated. I filled a carry-on bag with a toothbrush, a clean t-shirt, and 16 pairs of fresh new socks, and boarded a bus to Mexico to live out my dream as a salesperson. Shin came with me. He brought his encyclopedias. Love, your brooder, Ian. The letter was typed on a piece of white stained paper, presumably the same piece which had sat stagnant and decrepit behind the curtain of weeping bonsais in his bedridden typewriter for the past year. It was the first thing he had written since the incident, and it was addressed to me. A week before he left Mexico, I boarded a train, with my proposal in tow, prepared to recruit the last party into the scheme, which, though largely Grandma Blue Jay's doing, held some of my own making in its birth, and more so now that I had become the sole delivery man of these very important packages. This being the last trek of my journey had proved to be the hardest, which was perhaps why I chose to crawl through the window into my brother's room, as opposed to going through the hassle that surely awaited me at the front desk. Ian's dog, Houndman, was not opposed to my visit at all, and greeted me with a wet lick on the cheekbone and an open invitation to join him in a game of fetched with a waterlogged tennis ball. Nonetheless, I locked him into the cupboard in case he changed his hospitable mind and decided to attack me, poured myself a glass of milk, and awaited my brother's arrival. Description footnote. Ian was the second tallest in line next to Kate. Kate, who had reached the height of 6'2" when she was just 15. In family photos, they stood almost the same height, Kate's brown mane of hair standing only half an inch above Ian's. Ian had a head of jet black hair when he was born, which quickly fell out and was replaced by a tawny, nearly tow-headed blonde. His hands were large, with long, tapered fingers, which flipped and rotated in illustration when he spoke. His unique way of holding himself set him apart from most men. He had what could only be described as a dainty, effeminate way of existing. The crossed legs as he sat and slowly smoked, the way he moved across the room as though he was gliding and at the same time tripping and stumbling in a lovely synchronized dance towards a final landing place. His air, unmistakably accidental in its power.
It's the unraveling. wanna knit you a sweater, wanna write you a love letter, wanna make you feel.